sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
New records across the board. The VIX plunges. We have the question answered of, what's the greatest economic challenge facing us? Great guest today, we have Professor Alan Krueger and Das. All this and much more on episode number 369 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello, how are you? Andrew Horowitz here, coming down to the end of June 2014, episode number 369 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Hope you're having a good summer. I just sent my last kid off to college. Kind of an emotional situation, you know. You get one, two, and your third finally off and giving them the wings to fly. It's a bit bittersweet, but it is something inevitable. And if you've had that experience before, you know what I'm talking about. But 4 years of college to go, and we'll see what happens from there. But otherwise, in the financial markets, we saw some new records after the rejoice of the commentary from Fed Chairman Yellen on basically saying, hey, there's just no inflation out there. And you know what? We're not worried about things. And in fact, we have to do more. And at this point, no bubbles, no problems. So we have a bit of a green light, I guess, what investors had hoped for. And we saw that the bonds were bought into that. We saw the world market somewhat rejoice, generally speaking. There's been some continued trouble in pockets around the world, still seeing that Russia and Ukraine are still having issues, of course, in Iran area with Iraq, questioning whether we're going to team up with one or the other to help out in terms of our military. And it looks like we have some advisors now going to Iraq, quote-unquote advisors, military advisors, a few hundred of them. I don't know what that means exactly, but it seems to mean that we have some forces that actually will be boots on the ground with the name of advisors, because we don't want to say that we have actually military there. No, that wouldn't be good politically. So we couch it in a different term, which is what seems to be always the helping factor. We also had a lot of new M&A, some IPOs on board coming out, and that's continuing to show some real good buoyancy in the markets. Next week, GoPro, the helmet cam company, which is pretty popular amongst the extreme sports folks and those people that like to capture their daily activities and then maybe blog them or post them or record them for their family, friends, history. That's going to be coming up public this week as well. And we also have the Case-Shiller numbers. There's a variety of things on the economic front. Last week was pretty light, although I would say that, generally speaking, we're seeing a very muted recovery continue. And I think that right now, although there is a very low interest rate environment and we're still seeing a drop by the Fed in the amount of bonds purchased each and every month, the fact is that the liquidity that is out there that has been brought by the ECB, by the Japan Central Bank there as well, and the U.S. is quite impressive. But at the other hand, I would say that we're seeing some questions in the area of housing. The recovery has seemed to have stalled a bit. And this is something I've been talking about for a while, and we are continuing to be short of some selective home builders. And I would keep a watch on the home builders right now for the direction of what's happening there. And, of course, we're continuing to see that technology has been hit or miss. Oracle had their earnings last week, and the company really did a good job at disappointing, and shares fell about 4.5%, 5%. They were down as much as, I think, 8% on the news item, but it's Oracle. It's optimism that we have that's very pervasive in the markets right now, and the hope is that next quarter, or maybe the quarter after that, they'll do a bit better. We have a couple of guests with us today, and we're going to get right to them so we don't waste any time. They have give them enough time to talk about what they have to talk about, so you don't have to listen to me the whole time. But I will mention that if you have any questions, send it to me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And, of course, the Aero strategy and the TDI Managed Growth strategy, all available on this edition's show notes. So go check that out on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. With that, let's get to our first guest. All right, so with Professor Alan Krueger, who was the chairman of President Barack Obama's Council of Economic Advisors and member of the cabinet from November 2011 to August 2013. Also served as Assistant Secretary of Economic Policy and Chief Economist of the U.S. Department of Treasury from 2009-2010. Currently at Princeton University, professor there. Hello, how are you, sir?
I'm fine, thank you.
Quite the resume. Very impressive.
Yeah, thank you.
Is it how is it getting back into kind of into you know working at Princeton versus at the White House? Was that a hard transition?
It's an adjustment. You know, it took a few months to get back in the swing of things.
Right. So a couple questions I wanted to ask you. So what I mean, do you have any idea in terms of have you thought through what's the biggest challenge to the U.S. economy right now?
Well, I think we face big short run challenges and big long run challenges. In the short run, I think the biggest challenge we face is 35% of the unemployed have been out of work for over half a year. The longer people are unemployed, the harder it is for them to get back into the job market. And the more likely it is that they'll leave the job market, take care of the house, do other things, and we'll have a smaller labor force in the long run. So that's the biggest short-run challenge, I think. In the long run, we face the problem of rising income inequality, middle class that's been shrinking, and we also have budget issues that we need to confront over the next decade.
So one of the things that I've been kind of talking about for a long time is this whole idea that, you know, or question is, do we have a structural unemployment issue? And it doesn't seem to me, I don't know why, it doesn't seem to me that there's been a lot of focus on the whole idea that, you know, there's a lot of technologies that's basically replacing or, you know, taking out certain areas of the economy that may or may not come back. I mean, we went to a an economy that did a lot of work to, you know, bring in foreign workers, not in the U.S. soil. I mean, you know, kind of like offset some of the workforce. You know, we see some of the things that are happening in that realm. Is there a structural unemployment issue in your opinion?
Well, I think we started with a cyclical unemployment problem. The financial crisis caused the unemployment rate to jump to 10%. And the longer people stay unemployed, the more it becomes a structural problem. So I think now it's morphing into a structural problem. That wasn't the case 3 years ago, where it was still a cyclical problem, in my view.
Right. I mean, you know, I guess also the big question of the day that everybody wants to know is, do we have inflation right now? And I keep on talking about how everything costs me more money. You know, you live up north, things are expensive up there. And, you know, I was recently in New York, and I was just absolutely blown away of how expensive everything in New York is, everything. And I've been there quite often, frankly, but I was really surprised. The traditional metric of inflation, utilizing the most recent revision in terms of how the data is compiled, shows that we really, you know, we're kind of just bouncing along at a level that doesn't seem to be too concerning in terms of central bank policy. But what is it that seems to be this disconnect between people paying a lot more money for things and the fact that we don't have inflation?
Well, overall inflation's been growing just under 2% over the last year. And I think part of the disconnect comes from that growth is not even across all goods and services. So food inflation, for example, has been running above 2%, and people see that every day. Healthcare has been a bit above 2%, although slower than it historically has been. But people still see those prices growing. And, of course, we've seen the strong rebound in housing prices and rent, and that is a big component of the inflation index.
So when we look at this whole inflation thing and we say, hey, central banks are around the world, I mean, listen, we just want negative rate on the ECB. This, you know, even more of an experiment in terms of central bank policy. Is there going to be inflation that is going to be runaway like all of the fear mongers are kind of talking about? Or is it kind of, you know, as long as we have this unemployment issue and no wage growth, is it going to kind of just keep on muddling along as we have it?
In my best guess in the U.S. is that we're going to see inflation edge up. I think that's what we've been seeing over the past 3 or 4 months. I think we'll also see a little bit more wage growth, which will be good for the economy. I don't think we're going to see runaway inflation. So I think the Federal Reserve's approach of taking a wait-and-see attitude, because inflation has been running below their 2% target over the last few years, I think that's probably the right approach for now.
Right. So I have a question for you, because this is something that's been a mystery to me. You know, oil prices. So we're seeing a lot of things happen throughout the world. There's some concern in certain areas. And obviously, when that happens, you may see some question about energy pricing. Oil prices in the 100-plus range, let's say. And then you go to maybe, let's say, 110, 120. There's this constant discussion about how, well, you know, higher oil prices that show higher prices at the pump don't necessarily dissuade consumers. But when oil prices go down, we hear a lot of people talking about, oh, that's good for the consumer because there's more money to spend. Did you ever do any work on really what is the net result of higher or lower gas price at the pump and how it does affect the consumer process?
I think the price of gasoline does have a big impact on consumers. It acts like a tax. You know, we're still importing a tremendous amount of oil, although our imports have declined as our domestic production has increased. And when the price of gasoline goes up, it means that households have less money to spend on other items. And we do see that translate into slower consumption, slower economic growth. Now, as the U.S. becomes more of a net producer of oil, less of a net importer, an increase in the price of oil will have less harm on our economy because it will help the domestic producers.
Yeah, it would seem like that should be an issue that obviously we focus in on, because obviously, you know, we're talking about the whole idea of electric. There's some legislation and discussion about coal and clean energy and all this. What about the whole energy environment? Is the U.S. turning into, or is it hopefully turning into, maybe a country that is not only more reliant on domestic production and oil independence, but also as a country that will gain meaningfully from an economic expansion of the revolution to clean energy and all that? Is that actually happening, or is that just still a pipe dream?
I think major changes are taking place in our energy production and consumption. The shale gas revolution, horizontal drilling, fracking, has really changed the landscape and greatly increased production of both natural gas and of oil. And it's an example of our system working the way it's supposed to work. You had government investment in new drilling techniques and promoting horizontal drilling. You had private sector entrepreneurs running with this technology. You had our financial system investing in it. And we're leading the world. And it's going to have, I think, profound implications down the road as the technology spreads to other countries, as we increase our exports. So that's happening on the supply side. And on the demand side, we are becoming more energy efficient. The car fleet is becoming more efficient. As people move more to cities, we're becoming more efficient in our energy consumption. We have a lot more work to do. Other countries are more energy efficient than we are, which suggests that we can gain a lot of ground. But I think we're seeing major changes in our energy environment.
Well, I appreciate it. Listen, I know you're pressed for time. I want to thank you for joining us, and we'll talk soon. Be well.
Sure. It's my pleasure.
Right.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And our second guest is our old friend Das, author of Traders, Guns, and Money, and the great book Extreme Money, all the way from Down Under. Das, good day.
Good day to you, too.
How are you?
I'm all right.
Yeah?
I'm all right.
Good.
Things are really great. I mean, the stock market's making new highs every day. You know, people are buying Kenyan bonds.
Yeah. Oh.
You know, things are pretty good.
Things are pretty good. Listen, the Italian yield, the yield on the Italian treasuries on the 10-year... all-time lows. Same thing with some of the other peripheral countries that just, oh, we got to think of a new name for them. They used to be the pigs. We got to think of something more uplifting, you know?
Well, how about flying pigs?
Yeah, flying pigs. Okay, that's good.
Flying pigs.
Yeah.
But, you know, Italy is not the least of your concerns. Cyprus came back to market. I mean, not since Hamlet's mother decided to marry her brother-in-law after he killed her husband have we seen such haste. Cyprus is back in bond market. You know, Cyprus is back in bond markets less than, you know, a year and a half after it defaulted. They issued 750 million euros of 5 years at 4.85.
Nice.
And I just find this quite astonishing, but I think this has to do with the massive amount of liquidity churning around and this entire belief that the whole system now is too big to fail and that the central banks and the governments will basically stand behind it. And I think one day, And I don't quite know when everybody's going to suddenly find that the economic and political risks that are increasing are going to come home to roost. And it's not going to end well.
No, it's not going to end well. But, you know, there's a lot of things going on. Some people are saying that there's a credit bubble. There is an extension of credit. One of the things that they point out is how the spread between high yield, corporate high yield, and treasury, let's say, are the thinnest that they've been in, you know, maybe forever. What does that say about what's happening inside the bond market? And the second part of that is, why is that happening?
Well, I think simply the fact that you have now, obviously, zero interest rates for a very prolonged period of time. You know, the interesting thing is, how long is long? Listen to the Fed chairman, Janet Yellen, one gets misleading impressions. You know, it's the end of next year, it's the end of whatever. But the most interesting one was Ben Bernanke, who, as soon as he retired, became almost comprehensible. And essentially, he's been giving speeches, and somebody was chatting to me about one of the speeches he gave. And he said he came away with the impression that Bernanke was saying that interest rates are not going to normalize in his lifetime.
Wow.
Now, he's in the 60s.
Wow.
So, you know, let's assume normal life expectancy. So he's talking about 10 to 20 years.
Hmm.
And I think if you look at Japan, that actually tells you that's not actually a completely idiotic statement. So I think everybody's assuming there's going to be very low interest rates. And what they're doing is buying anything which provides some semblance of income. I'll give you a very good example. They're buying Kenya, the Republic of Kenya, good, lovely place to visit.
Mm-hmm.
They've issued $2 billion of two-year bonds, and the major attraction seems to be 6.875 was the coupon. Now, let's put this into perspective. The first thing is the president of Kenya has some restrictions on travel because there's a warrant out for his arrest in the International Court of Criminal Justice for atrocities and crimes against humanity. The head of the central bank couldn't travel on the roadshow because he's fighting charges of graft and corruption. The finance minister had to leave the roadshow early to go back to announce an increase in the budget deficit to about $4 billion. And the Al-Shabaab militants from Somalia crossed the border and killed 48 people. And the tourism industry, which is one of their staples, is basically in turmoil. So people aren't looking at the risks at all. And I love the Kenyan issue for another reason. The Kenyan issue, when I was looking at all the sell-side analysts' reports on it, there was one that just caught my eye. And they basically were saying, look, you know, frontier markets are risky, so you should diversify. I parse that as, you're going to lose money anyway, so you might as well lose it across a range of issues rather than just in a single one.
Right.
And it's just extraordinary. And this is not only in bonds, it's in stocks. And you just see the tech sector, the biotech sector, which is grossly inflated because people are just desperate for anything which gives you growth because there ain't none around. And one striking fact, which people often forget about the stock market at the moment, is firstly, people aren't buying stocks for growth for the main part. They're buying it for yield, which is kind of weird. You buy stocks for yield and bonds for something else, bonds for capital growth. It's just kind of weird.
Yeah, world. No. It's the correlations are totally broken down. But by the way, about Kenya, I'm assuming that their bond issuance was probably oversubscribed.
Oh, yes. Oh, come on. It'll be oversubscribed at least 3 to 5 times, you know. I mean, it's just crazy. And the world is a very, very strange place at the moment. And as you and I have discussed before, I think the most interesting thing about once you run an economy in this way or a financial system in this way by pumping money in, the actual process of pricing risk breaks down. And that's what's happened. There's no pricing of risk anymore because everybody's assuming that it doesn't matter anymore. And to some extent, I can understand why they're doing it because how else are they going to make money?
Yeah. Well, but here's what's interesting. The Chairman Yellen had talked about how, you know, they're going to continue to keep their pace of bond purchases reducing down a bit. You know, still at the same time, they're doing a bunch of reinvestment on the side anyway. They also keeping the interest rates low for a period of time. Talked about inflation. When asked about it, she said, well, that last couple were noisy. I'm thinking to myself, noisy? They were noisy because they were screaming to you that there's something bubbling up under the surface. We all know that food prices have been moving higher, and we all know that, you know, generally speaking, fuel prices, I mean, you could discount all you want, but the fact is there is some inflation that is starting to percolate, maybe not in a big way, but she pretty much discounted that entirely. And I think that was one of the biggest points of what she said and why markets really took off after that, because they just have no, I think, real core understanding, unfortunately, maybe I don't know, something of what's going on in terms of the when to unwind this, because they not because they're stupid, because this is all one gigantic experiment.
Well, I think William White from the Bank of International Settlement, he's a Canadian economist who used to be one of the senior economists of the Bank of International Settlement, and he's now retired. He actually gave a rather interesting interview on CNBC where he said pretty much the central banks had no idea what they were doing and they were making it up as they're going along. And I think that's probably true. But coming back to the actual taper, it's actually quite fascinating how the taper has taken on a life of its own. But the reality is, if you look at what I would call the path to normalization of interest rates and so forth, there's four or five components to it as far as the U.S. is concerned. The one is stopping new purchases, and they've certainly won that back. But to a large extent, winding back the purchase of treasuries to some extent doesn't have much impact in the present environment, because the government budget deficit has come down as well. So, and basically, the Fed was buying round about between 50 and 80% of all Fed issuance. So under those circumstances, the fact that the Fed is issuing less means you don't feel the pressure. But there's four other elements that are really crucial to this. One is reinvestment of the actual cash coming back into the portfolio. They haven't changed their stance on that, so they continue to reinvest. And the balance sheet assets they have, they show no signs of selling, because I don't think they can sell. And the other thing is, they made it very clear that interest rates are going to stay low. And as you say, given where inflation is currently, it basically doesn't make a lot of sense to keep interest rates where it is. And I agree with you. The real threat is, in most tradables, I don't think there's going to be inflation. But I think food and energy, for their own dynamics, which have nothing to do really with finance, they're mainly to do with geopolitics and climate issues and so forth, are going to put pressure on that. So basically, they're going to have effectively negative real interest rates for a prolonged period of time. So it's not only low interest rates, it's actually negative real interest rates. And there's also the other issue of what the government does on the fiscal front. I'll give you a very funny story about that. The Europeans have committed under the Stability and Growth Pact to running a 3% before interest surplus. Now, the most amusing thing is, after the European elections, what happened is everybody was very scared of these fringe parties. So they've now changed they're not talking about changing the definition. So it's the 3% will be not only excluding interest, but any investment the government makes in growth, which is kind of a fuzzy term, which basically means none of these numbers make any sense anymore either. So I don't think we are seeing a taper. And the most important thing is, even if the Fed is winding back, there is absolutely no sign that other central banks, particularly the ECB, the European Central Bank, Japan, and particularly China, are winding back. So globally, there is a glut of liquidity, and I don't think that's going to change anytime soon.
Listen, they can't, first of all, when you look at the funny thing about, and I think the real thing that's very fascinating to me, is that, you know, you can move the ball wherever you want it to be. So, for example, in Italy recently, when they announced that they're going to include illicit and illegal drug purchases as well as prostitution into the GDP, that was like, oh, that's interesting. Now, are you going to use that as on a comparative basis? Are you going to somehow look at that, or are you just going to throw it in there and look like, oh, we have much better GDP at this point? And moreover, how do you actually quantify that? I mean, what do you do? You got to take, you have a line item for pimp information, and do you have a line item for dealer information? How does that exactly work? So
you just have no imagination.
I know.
Oh,
so boring.
I mean, the opportunities for manipulating these numbers are absolutely endless. And if you want to go to the British have what's called the ONS, the Office of National Statistics, which actually has a paper on its website of how they're going to calculate the GDP effect of prostitution. And I just wanted to know how they did the field research.
That's what I wanted to know.
It's just quite astonishing.
That's half the fun.
You're absolutely correct. They're manipulating these numbers. Now they're manipulating inflation numbers. They're going to manipulate GDP numbers. The reality is they have no way really of actually controlling this process. And I think they are just now trying to play the long con. It's just a long con.
It's exactly what China did for a long period of time. And now what happens is that with the situation, with the balance sheet assets that the Fed has, I don't think they have any idea how to really unwind this, because not a desire, but any idea on how to unwind this. And it can, I think, being shown by the speech that Janet Yellen had in an environment that we're seeing much better employment than there was, and a tick up in inflation compared to where it was, and her comment that even if we get towards our target of appropriate employment and inflation, we're going to continue having a low interest rate environment for a prolonged period of time. And I thought to myself, what is the point of having targets? I mean, if you're just going to do it, what's the point? I mean, just for what point? Is it for the amusement? I mean, in essence, we don't need a Fed anymore. If you're just going to keep interest rates low, you're just going to have a process. It could be totally automated. And then on top of it, to have the leak that the Fed is looking into, looking at bond funds and maybe even ETFs and other places, but bond funds putting an exit fee in the event there is withdrawals from bond funds, it smelled of desperation.
Look, just let's take the Fed. It's actually interesting to look at the Fed. They've got assets of give or take, say, $4 trillion. They've got $54 billion in capital. And when originally Bernanke announced the taper and interest rates spiked, the 10-year, say, spiked up almost 1%, then what happened was the mark-to-market swing on their P&L meant they had no capital. Now, theoretically, a central bank does not have to have capital to operate because they can just print money. But it's not a good look when your central bank actually is insolvent. It's not a good look. So basically, they can't really do anything which jeopardizes their existing holdings. So you're quite correct. And the exit tax is a direct, absolutely direct, linear response to the fact that straight after the original Bernanke announcement, there was a massive outflow from bond funds, which is quite predictable. So what they're trying to do now is try to cover all the bases. And you're quite correct, it's max of desperation. But just think about it. We've got low interest rates, and growth is anemic. One of the most amusing things is all the commentary and the way the stock market reacts every time Yellen says that rates are going to stay low. My question is, if things are so great, then why do you have to keep interest rates low? And I agree the economy's picked up, but I think it's only picked up because of this massive monetary accommodation, which has a number of effects, one of which is to keep the U.S. dollar low. And you will have noticed the ECB is trying to actually lower the euro against the U.S. as well. So they actually have very little capacity to actually grow the economy. It's not self-sustaining. And the other thing here, which is, in my view, even more crucial, is if they push up interest rates, the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, did an interesting calculation. And the calculation was that if interest rates go up 1% in the G8, or I can't remember if it was the G8, I think it was the G8 economy, the losses will be $2.3 trillion, which is about 4% of global GDP. So essentially, there's just no way they can do that. And I think fundamentally what we're seeing is really a Ponzi game. And we all know how a Ponzi game works. You've got to get more people coming in, and you've got to widen group of people coming in to keep the game going. And essentially now they've got to keep expanding the monetary base and keep rates low almost until the game finally ends in some shape or form. So they've got no choice. I mean, just look at U.S. households. If you push up rates by 1%, their debt payments go up by 7% because of the leverage.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just no way they can actually sustain that. And more importantly, if that happens, how's the economy going to grow?
You know, it's interesting because as the U.S. continues with their monetary program, which obviously benefits the world to a degree, we're seeing that other countries now have to come in and do even more, like what we saw what happened with Japan and what we're seeing that happens with the ECB. So the ECB goes one step further. They go one step further and they say, we're going to put negative deposit rates on central bank deposits from banks, okay? There's a massive withdrawal. I think it's something like $25 billion the day before this announcement because everybody knows what was coming and the leaks were out there, et cetera. And What we have now is an ECB that has one thing they held back, which was the asset-backed purchases. Now, here's my theory on this. My theory is the ECB basically signals to the banks, hey, here's the deal. We're going negative on deposit rates. That means get your money out of us and go send it somewhere else. Put it on the street, lend it out, invest it, do whatever you got to do. But here's the point. We want you to try to do it into something like mortgages and car loans and things to help the consumer. And if that fails, by the way, one thing, notice what we did. We held back, but we saved it for potential use later, was asset-backed security purchases. Because if things fail, if for whatever reason loans default and all that, and you're on the hook for it, we'll buy it from you.
Indeed. And I think you're absolutely correct about the ECB strategy. The ECB strategy is clearly got three or four legs. One of the legs, which I think is probably crucial, is to actually start to pump credit into the real economy to try to grow. Now, just let's work our way through that. And there's two things they've done. One is what they call the targeted LTRO, the targeted long-term refinancing operation. Now, the second thing is the ABS purchases you're talking about. That's the first leg. Let's just look at that objectively. The first thing is they don't want what happened the first time around, because they've done two rounds of LTRO already. And what happened was the banks just took the money at 0.6% and went and bought government bonds at 2% and 3%. That's all they did. So they want them to lend the money, but it's not as easy as that, simply because the first thing is there has to be demand for credit. And if you actually look at Europe, it has a Japan-style balance sheet recession, and credit demand is extremely weak. So on its own, it's not going to do it. The second thing is, the actual problem they have is banks aren't willing to lend. And the reason they're not willing to lend is their capital position is impaired for a variety of reasons, one of which is obviously the recession. The other is the new regulations that are coming in, which are more restrictive. So basically, Mario Draghi is essentially trying to put his foot on the accelerator and press down, while banking regulators on the other side are basically putting their foot on the brake. So it's just not going to work. But the other thing which is hilarious, and this is very European, you know, I'm beginning to take after Donald Rumsfeld in terms of views on Europe, old Europe. Old Europe is fairly incompetent. So essentially they say, well, this is targeted, right? And then I asked a question of a couple of people I know. I said, well, okay, it's targeted to small businesses and real businesses and mortgages, as you say. Except the first thing is they actually excluded mortgages. You can't actually do that. For mortgage lending, they've excluded that because the Germans and the Finns apparently threw a tantrum mm-hmm. on mortgages. So they've taken out mortgages. And I said, okay, well, how are you going to control this? Because money is fungible. It goes onto the liability side of a bank's balance sheet. And then basically, how do you control what they do with the money on the other side? And they go, we don't know. I said, so you're saying this is going to happen in this way, but you actually have no controls over it. Oh, we'll ask them to report to us that they've done it. This is like basically asking thieves to hand themselves in.
Yeah, no, the whole thing, like you said, it's a. I hate to use the word Ponzi scheme or anything like that, because it sounds so, you know, it sounds so bitter and something. But the whole thing stinks to high hell that the continuation of the battle to bring down the dollar, the euro, whatever. It's funny that the euro did in fact go up the day of the Draghi announcement. I call it the Draghi drop. But the euro did come up and then it started to squeak down ever so slightly for a couple of days, maybe a week. And then it started moving back up after Yellen came out with her comments. And what was really interesting was that there was a little bit of a sell-off, ever so slight, but into it there was a incredible buy into bonds. Now, you know, where's this money come from? You know, could it be some of the Europeans that had to pull their money out and said, hey, you know what, we're not going to buy European bonds at this point. We'll buy U.S. bonds, you know, take all that money and buy it. And we know that liquidity is tight on bonds, on treasuries, because the Fed's not selling, so there's nothing there. The issuance is lower, like you said. And the fact is, it's a little bit tight in that area. So the thing is, you know, where is this all playing out?
Well, the euro is very interesting because clearly the ECB wants to weaken the euro. And there's two reasons for that. One is obviously to give export competitiveness. The other one is simply that they believe it's causing deflationary pressures in Europe. And Europe is going into a deflationary spiral or a disinflationary spiral. That's a given, I think, now. But the most interesting thing about that is, as you say, the euro actually rallied after the announcement. The answer is why? Okay, the question is why? And the answer is fairly simple. One is, if you now looked around and said, okay, what am I going to do? the basic thing is the announcements are very good for the bond market. So everybody rushed in to buy things like Cyprus, Italy, Greece, all of these places, because they can see the yields falling another 50 to 100 basis points under this process. So they bought that. So that's completely counterintuitive. So the euro went up. The other thing is that the countervailing argument is the euro rates are now so low. You use that as a carry currency, so you borrow in that currency and buy higher-yielding assets. But I think the two just about cancel themselves out. And the final thing is, you're assuming here that other central banks around the world do nothing, which they're not going to stand by and do, because everybody wants the cheapest currency. And this is the point that you were making earlier, which is actually a very important point. It sets off, essentially, a terrible spiral to the bottom, because you force everybody to actually have zero interest rates. And the more you do that, you create a dysfunctional economy, and basically what you do is you force up the debt levels in the world, because everybody's going to borrow if rates are zero. And that's, but it's not productive borrowing. It's not going into investment. It's not going to go to anything sensible. And all that does is set you up for a period of massive financial instability down the track.
Yeah, but nobody is believing that there's anything happening, because, you know, there's no let up of buying anything and everything. It's almost a shark-like feeding frenzy on bonds. Back to the idea of high yields being so so much aligned with treasuries, and even looking at some of the lower debt rated or lower countries around the world having yields this low, the appetite for yield, and again, wherever the money's coming from, is insatiable at this point.
You're absolutely right. And this is one of those things. I think there's Herbert Stein, the economist, had a statement that if something is not sustainable, it will stop. And it will stop, but it's not going to stop just yet. And it's going to stop, I think, when one of two or three things happen. The first thing is a regulator somewhere makes a tragic miscalculation and somebody just overplays their hand. And, you know, these people are not in control of the system, and so they basically pretend they are. And there's a huge problem that somebody's going to look and press the red button and then ask, what was that button for again? So that could happen. And, you know, the higher risks here are the bigger central banks, and they're going to make a tragic miscalculation at some stage. The other thing is the social and political risks arising. Now, if you actually look at the social risks, look at long-term unemployment. It's improved, but it hasn't improved to a great degree. And there's a whole class that's growing up, which is completely disenfranchised. And you can see this in the European elections, where the fringe parties, both on the far right and the far left, made considerable gains. And to give you an idea of the hubris of, I suppose, the political elites, their justification for not being worried, they said, well, 60% of people voted in favor of Europe, 40% voted against. And so everything's fine. And my reaction to that was, if 10% change their minds, it's not so fine. And they will, because their futures are just basically being decimated. So there's going to be pressure from that. And the other interesting thing about that is what's happening in domestic politics in Europe. So, for instance, look, to some extent, the European elections, the European Parliament elections are a waste of time, because, you know, you have people like Nigel Farage being elected to the European Parliament, and his agenda is to actually unwind Europe. So you get elected to the European Parliament to destroy it, and they're paying you to do this. It's kind of a weird world. But the most important thing is that domestic agendas are now changing in certain places like Italy and France. They've given up on austerity. They're not going to basically obey the budget targets. It just makes the problems much worse, the debt problems much worse. So that's the social and the economic will get linked. The other thing is there is now a crescent of instability which starts at Morocco, goes in a nice little arc all the way to Japan. We obviously know of the problems in North Africa, where the Arab Spring has turned to winter without actually bypassing through summer and autumn. And we know the problems in Syria. We know the problems in Iraq. Iraq is a very, very serious, because this is basically a Sunni Shia, basically religious war. And it may be more under control, but basically it's going to fester for a long time. We have Afghanistan, when Karzai goes. The same thing's going to happen. The Taliban are going to come back. And then you look at the Chinese and their territorial disputes with various Asian neighbors. And those risks are completely, totally not factored into the markets at all.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you look at what I thought was fascinating was when the elections hit in Europe, and clearly there was a swath of people that were brought in that were anti-euro, the entire process, and markets in general, whether it were bond or equity markets, didn't flinch.
No, they didn't flinch at all. And I think the whole thing here is, it's kind of, everybody knows the end game is horrible, so everybody's shutting their eyes and saying, okay, well, it doesn't really matter. We'll just, you know, keep buying. It almost reminds me of the Prince song, Let's Party Like It's 1999.
Right, and what you do is you just keep on playing until the music's, or musical chairs for that matter.
Well, actually, good old Chuck Prince's famous statement that, you know, one day the music will stop, but the music's still playing, and so we're dancing.
Right, exactly.
It's playing out, and we're all doing it. And the most interesting thing about this, though, is everybody I've spoken to in the last probably 6 months, 9 months, seems to have this innate belief that they will, A, know when the music is going to stop, mm-hmm. so they'll get an advanced email saying the music is about to stop tomorrow, and secondly, that they'll be able to exit. And this is the really interesting thing about the exit. I had a look at the liquidity in bond markets and so forth. And I also have some personal experience with some work I did for some people in unwinding some positions. Liquidity is poor, and dealer inventory levels are very much lower than they used to be pre-2007 for a whole variety of reasons. One is the number of dealers are lower. Then the regulatory environment has changed, the liquidity environment, things like the Volcker rule. And so what that means is inventory levels have fallen 50, in some cases 80%. So what will happen is if when people hit the eject button, there's just not going to be the capacity to absorb this. And that will create very, very sharp price falls and volatility. And I'm fascinated by this debate that's taking place about low volatility. And I think the fundamental thing is you can't judge volatility by, A, looking at implied volatility, simply because that's just a bunch of people's estimates of what volatility is going to be. If you look at real volatility, in other words, day-to-day movements, it's not unusual now for a couple of days in the month to see the 10-year bond move 5, 6, 7, 8 basis points now, which is a very large move, particularly when you consider right. The base is only 2.5.
Right.
People are ignoring that. And I think what's going to happen is in this attempt to force down volatility to low levels, what they're going to do is create huge pressure. It's like a pressure cooker. They're going to create huge pressure. And one day, they're going to basically get the lid blown off. I remember, and probably Andrew, you do, in the late 1990s, one day, the yen traded 27 big figures in a single day. It mm-hmm. went up and down,
right.
But it was 27 big figures, which is like around about 30% of what the yen was that day. And you're going to get a day like that, and then all bets are off.
Right. Then everybody's going to think that's the alert. Now, one of the good things that you get out of this low interest rate environment, though, there are some benefits in that the corporations in the world can refinance. They could actually issue debt at a low level. They could do things like buybacks, which, you know, can't last forever, but they definitely enhance earnings. And you also have the potential for significant amounts of very low-cost acquisitions. And that's what's going on right now. And that's actually a good thing in some regards in that it does create efficiencies in corporate America and in the world. And I think that's a good thing, right? I mean, that is one of the benefits of this.
Look, the stock markets are being buoyed by some fundamental factors, one of which is obviously higher earnings. There's no doubt about that. But I think, to some extent, you have to determine whether it's a short-term phenomenon or a long-term phenomenon. Now, looking at just earnings around the world, only about 20% of the increased earnings is coming from the top line, from the revenue line. 80% is coming from cost savings. And you're absolutely correct. Low capital costs, low interest rates, essentially means that you can actually go and create efficiencies. There's a kind of a paradox at work, though, here. The paradox is that essentially what's happening is one of the ways you're getting those cost efficiencies is getting rid of people, but your economy is 60-70% consumption. So if you get rid of these people, the question is, who's going to buy your product? And that's one of the the conundrums that we have. And if you actually look at this very carefully, this is at the heart of the debate that people like Lawrence Summers, with their secular stagnation thesis in their convoluted language, are really talking about. That's number one. Number two, it also creates a kind of perverse process. You're absolutely correct. Stock returns are coming from things like stock buybacks, increases in dividends, all of those types of good things, and they're good. The issue there is, though, it creates this kind of interesting feedback loop. And Robert Buckland, who's an analyst at Citibank, was one of the first people to actually identify this. He said, what's actually happening is people are now buying stocks for yield. So what that does is put pressure on corporate management to create cost efficiency, because revenue is not growing that quickly, to increase bottom lines, to actually effectively provide those dividend streams. And that means they're getting rid of more people. So in fact, QE through low interest rates is actually not good for employment. It's actually bad for employment. And the other thing is, and this is where the Fed flow of funds information that came out for the first quarter was very interesting, corporate debt has gone up 9%. It's actually quite interesting. GDP went down in that first quarter because of so-called weather, but corporate debt went up quite significantly. And the interesting thing is, I suspect a lot of that is to do with things like stock buybacks and dividends, very little to do with actually investment. And if you look at the investment statistics, they're fairly stagnant. And so that's kind of interesting. The other thing is, buying companies, that's actually fine. I don't have a problem with that, because if you buy well, you do well. But the evidence overwhelmingly of acquisitions is that about 20% of them work out, 80% of them are disaster. And I think we all have scar tissue from AOL, Time Warner, and a few like that down the track. Now, it'll be interesting to see whether this generation has bought better. But my suspicion is that effectively we're going to have some problems. The other thing is that many of these mergers are cost efficiency driven, which has employment impacts, because they're going to chop heads by consolidating. And the other group of acquisitions, which is like Facebook's acquisition of WhatsApp and some of the other acquisitions that are taking place, is essentially about trying to create growth options. And some of them will work, but some of them will not work. And again, some of those acquisitions are actually employment reducing. I'll give you a very, very interesting example of that, which is everybody sort of getting themselves into a froth over Uber, which is the taxi booking system around the world. Mm-hmm. But let's have a look at what the effect of that is. It's basically lowering the returns to all the drivers, right, which is why they're complaining, number one. Number two, if you actually read the material that Uber itself has put out, their whole agenda here is actually to eliminate drivers, and they want to link into Google's driverless cars. So basically, that might be beneficial at one level, but, you know, what's going to happen to all those people who drive cabs?
Right.
So there's a lot of complex issues being played out, and we need, as a society, as a global economy, to have a sensible debate about that, but the answer now seems to be to just pump more money into the economy. I think, I don't know whether you remember, there was a Saturday Night Live skit involving Christopher Walken and the Blue Oyster Cult, the band. And it's called More Cowbell. And they were recording what is actually the Grim Reaper, the song.
Mm-hmm.
But in it, there's cowbell playing. And Christopher Walken, who's the producer, keeps walking in saying, more cowbell, more cowbell. And I think at the moment, the central bankers around the world are screaming, more cowbell.
Yeah.
That's all they're doing.
My favorite Uber story, real quickly, was when there was a recent taxi strike. I believe it was in London. And the taxi drivers were just absolutely, you know, all up in arms about the fact that, well, this Uber thing, and it's going to be a problem. So they all went on strike. And what happened? Well, everybody out there needed taxis. So what they do is everybody got, it was a great marketing deal for Uber.
Absolutely.
They went out and did. The second thing is, you know, you look at a company like FedEx recently increasing their rates. And within, I don't know, a week maybe, saying they were increasing their dividend. So essentially what happened there was that they increased the rate that they were going to be charging to customers and then paying that out to shareholders. Now, in essence, that's the way things go. Of course, you know, more profitability for owners, no problem. But at the same time, is I think a real understanding and a realization that higher yield makes for a higher stock price. And then finally, this is the most fascinating thing, I think, when it comes to M&A activity these days. Way back in time, when we used to see M&A, whether or not it was really initially accretive or not, for the most part, the acquiring company's stock would go down initially, and the acquired stock would go up. These days, because they're using words like, you know, initially or immediately accretive or whatever may be, you're finding that there is just an incredible buy of both the acquirer and the acquired. And that's either saying to me that, okay, they've learned how to do this in a way that makes sense, or it's just that people are, in a way, Pavlovian and just buying because there is news.
I think you're probably right. It's going to be interesting to see which of those two theories is right. And I think, like all things, in some cases, it'll be one or the other. But I think we are in a completely overrated or overheated market in that sense. There's no doubt. But everybody's going to stay on their feet and stay dancing because they really have no choice. There's a very famous quip by Warren Buffett is that, you know, nobody likes to leave a party because, you know, everybody's having such a hell of a good time. But the problem is, you know, at midnight, it's like Cinderella the ball. You know, at midnight, you're all going to turn into pumpkins. The problem is, nobody wants to leave till 1 minute past midnight.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is, everybody's dancing in a room where the clocks have no hands. And that's a very, very good way to think about what's happening. And I hope people get it right, but history shows you often don't.
And we can look at it like, you know, the Fed being kind of like the purveyors of oxygen in the Las Vegas casinos. No clocks, no knowledge of time, and pumping oxygen to keep us wide awake and playing. So I guess we're all dancing to a chorus of cowbells. So I want to thank you very much for joining us. As always, my good friend Das, and we will touch base very shortly. Great information.
Nice to talk to you, Andrew.
All right, buddy. Be well.
Stay well.
Now, here's the thing. You know, Das puts up some great points, and of course, we look at some of the commentary from Professor Krueger about where things are going, and clearly, we know that, and we could see empirically, and we could take a look at the evidence from a lot of different ways, not only just looking at simply the numbers, but clearly the economy has gotten a lot better, not only here, but around the world. There are still some pockets, as I mentioned, of concern, but here's the big rub. The big rub is that it's all been done on a lot of Fed stimulus efforts with the notion that we're still not out of the woods. And one of the big questions I continue to have is, how do we really unwind a lot of this? How do we get out of this and get into an economy where we have holistic growth? You know, we just have simple growth that is based on economic activity that is not artificially stimulated to a degree. Now, I realize that the Fed is always going to be in there in some degree or another. They're going to be, you know, doing things like slowing the economy down and making it a little bit faster by changing their interest rate numbers. But we have a real problem when it comes to the tax situation, the tax rates that we have right now. And in the end, we know that really it's very rare, if ever, that we have seen the policy of the Fed being right on, where you can create the ultimate soft landing, as most would like to see. Of course, we see that in China, there's a real struggle after the major boom that they had and the property boom they had for a number of years is starting to fall apart. It's just crumbling. You see recent reports on the last several months that housing prices have been going down, which on one hand is good because it was really getting out of control, the amount of growth they had in the prices, the underlying prices of the housing and in the housing market, and many questions about, well, is there really that much of the ghost houses that have been developed there? The stockpiling that's gone on in terms of commodities, particularly copper, and what's happening. I don't know if you've looked at the stories and read the documentation on what has actually gone on with the margining, the loans that had been taken, and the collateralization of the materials at the ports and in China in their supply line. But one of the problems has been that the distortion of the values and the needed amount of actual commodities that has been coming out is really quite astonishing. By utilizing the loans and collateralizing it against each other and buying more and more in hopes that, I guess, it will be consumed one day at a higher price, when we have seen that copper has continued to really lag in terms of the long-term basis of prices, and we're seeing that The concern keeps on mounting. The big question is going to be, is that a weird bubble, an oddity in terms of how they structure this? Simply correlated and viewed as we would housing, where there was so much excess put on in terms of loans, and then when the market came in, when the levels of housing growth slowed down, the whole thing just crumbled. This is going to be something to watch very, very carefully. I promise you, you're going to see a lot more about this coming very soon. Now, of course, China does a good job at hiding a lot of their information, and you know, we're not going to possibly see the full brunt of this, but I think this is really showing signs and affecting their economy all over, because the numbers that we saw, the assumptions that we made in terms of their building infrastructure, their imports, et cetera, have really been questioned to a much greater degree than we've seen in, you know, I guess over the last, probably the last year, I would say. Because I think that before that, a lot of people that were raising the red flag were just seen as just idiots. You know, you're just being negative. So we'll see what's happening there. Also, coming up next week with the economics in the U.S., and then the following week, we're back on jobs hunt again. We're looking at the jobs numbers in the beginning of July. Once again, we're going to be seeing the numbers and how things stack up. So be on alert. Listen to us on DH Unplugged Tuesdays. We record Wednesdays. Tuesday nights, we let it go. And hopefully you will be a part of Dvorak Horowitz Unplugged. Any questions? Ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. See you next week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.